Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman. Ted Rao, welcome to the Exagility podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
Ted, which part of the world are you in today?
I am in Massachusetts, in a small town in western Massachusetts, so about 2 hours from Boston.
Very nice. We're here to review your book, Many Voices, One Song, with Sociocracy, and it's published through Sociocracy for All. It's a lovely book. I love the feel of the book, the cover. It's really, really nice, and I got into it. I'm curious, Ted, how you even got into Sociocracy in the first place. What was your path to Sociocracy?
Well, originally, of course, I was doing something completely different. My background is in academia and linguistics. I did my PhD in Germany. So those who are wondering, my accent is German, though it has been fading the last few years. And then I moved to the US for a postdoc. And after that program ended, I didn't really know what to do. So we were kind of stranded and then decided to stay in the US, mostly because of family reasons. And then we moved into an intentional community, which I will explain in a moment what that is, but that community was run sociocratically. So as I was looking to reorient myself, that kind of fell into my lap, honestly, and I got very excited about it. So an intentional community means about 70, 80 people living together and sharing resources together, like a big building in some way. So it's medium-sized organization running things together, and that's why I was able to see Sociocracy firsthand, because that's how it runs here. But then I also noticed over the years, and honestly, it took me several years to realize that the patterns that are inherent in Sociocracy are also very similar to the patterns that I studied in language. So basically, I am, after all, still doing the same thing. But that's how that all started.
Thank you, Ted. Was this your first book, this book in Sociocracy, the one that I'm reviewing here, or have you written other books before also?
Well, in that field, yes. And then afterwards, I wrote Who Decides Who Decides, which is more towards some startups. And I'm currently working on it. That's going to come out in fall this year. But that was the big, Many Voices, One Song was the big beginning kind of in that field.
Very good. Okay. So let's get started, shall we? Let's have a look into the book. So at the very, very start of the book, chapter one, it says Sociocracy, Why, What, and Who. And down at the bottom of the page, I see We Distribute Power more evenly. So that really struck me straight away. In fact, right throughout the book, there was a theme of consent, which is where essentially decisions get made unless someone objects kind of thing, is kind of the sense that you don't have to get everybody aligned and all that kind of stuff. But also, just very quickly into it as well, you talk about organizations as living systems, and there's some principles to underpin it as well, like equivalence, no one is ignored, distributed leadership, looking for win-win, open to emergence, open to feedback, but feedback-rich environments and decisions by few, input from many. And in fact, there's more omnidirectional flow of information, transparency, good enough for now and safe enough to try are two key slogans that are mentioned. And you mentioned intentionality, which is described here as when we do things with intentionality, we have agency. We are in choice over what we do. And you also talk about tensions. That tensions can point to lack of clarity. When there's a tension, it can mean that something isn't clear. And you give some examples of the book as well, where there's gaps and where there's overlap and when there's handoffs versus handovers as well. You also talk about effectiveness. But equivalence is the first thing that really pops into me on page 5, and you even went to the trouble of explaining it. And would you mind, Ted, kind of drilling in a little bit more into equivalence and why that's so significant in Sociocracy?
Yeah, it is really one of the pillars, equivalence, meaning every person has the same value. That doesn't mean that we're all the same, right? Because we want an organization where everybody's doing different things. We want division of labor, obviously. That's also, by the way, why we chose that metaphor of Many Voices, One Song. Because in organizations, people often get caught up, you know, especially in workplaces, they get caught up with how things should be and what they've learned about what organizations are. But if we think back to a choir, we know that if we all sing the same tune, it's not going to be, I mean, it can be, you know, sing in unison, there's a lot to say for it. But if we want to sing a multi-part harmony, it's actually good if everybody sings something different. And then how it fits together, that's what makes the song. So we might be singing the same song, but we might be doing different things in order, you know, whatever our part is. So that's one of the metaphors that really works. And then the equivalence piece comes in. If you think, let's, you know, solos aside, if we want to sing together, it's important that we're aligned with each other and that not one of us is trying to make it a one-person show, right? So if there's imbalance, it's typically not so cohesive to the needs of the collective. So equivalence is kind of the baseline on which everything is built. So we need to understand that in order to align towards our higher shared purpose, we need to bring some cohesion to our individual needs with the organization's needs. So equivalence is one of the building blocks in that. And then to the other keywords that you mentioned, hierarchical organizations tend to be rigid, right? They have a hard time adapting. They lose information all the time because people don't speak up. So there's just so much waste created and so little opportunity to learn and adapt and be resilient. So then a self-organized system like sociocracy is a good antidote for that. But I want to also go just really briefly on that point of intentionality, because it's something that just recently really is more top of mind these days again, because one thing that's important to me is that sociocracy or a system like sociocracy doesn't mean that it's 100% a flat organization. That's actually not what it means, but it means that we can choose how much hierarchy and what kind of hierarchy we build for ourselves. It's that intentionality that makes the difference, not how flat or not flat the organization is.
Indeed, you mentioned actually between page 9 and page 10, you said intentional communities were grappling with their own governance, but there are places where there's not an endless seesaw of power or domination by majority rule, and accountability is to the whole, not only to the supervisor. Leadership is distributed and no one can be ignored. So I guess if somebody has an issue with something, they're going to be kind of objecting, which is kind of where the consent kicks in, right? Because with consent, something proceeds unless someone objects. So if someone objects, that's how they're not being ignored. Is that correct, Ted?
Yes. So also just a little bit of underpinning for people to grasp that. Yeah. So if we assume that we're all working together, everybody does their thing, right? Everybody knows things because they're involved in concrete work. Then if one of my teammates notices that a proposal that I put on the table is not going to work because of something that they see and only uniquely maybe they can see because of the nature of their work. If they say, hold on, Ted, this proposal is not going to work because this and this and that, then in this mindset of looking for alignment towards that shared purpose or that shared common goal, it would be pretty stupid to ignore what that person said, right? Because if they see a reason of how my proposal will fail and will just hit a wall, why would I ignore that? But that is what happens in a hierarchical organization, right? People say things and then it's like whoever has the most power just can overrule that. And here it's really about, wait, what is that shared aim? And we typically have it written down so we know what our shared purpose is. It's not something made up. It's something that we agreed upon. And everything we do is measured against that. So an objection is not, I don't like it. And maybe also not even, I have an issue with that, but our shared purpose has an issue with that, and I'm going to bring it up on behalf, or like speaking on behalf of the group, basically. So consent is really almost like it's something on group level and on organization level, and individuals help us surface those things because they have insight into all the areas of the organization.
So you just reminded me, Ted, that in People and Change, John Cotter, the famous People and Change guy, he had a famous talk, it's still up on YouTube, Resistance to Change. He talks about no-no characters, you know. He talks about people who object to a change. These are the people who like say no to any change, no matter how good the idea is, you know. But actually, I don't have a problem with people who say no, quite honestly, because at least they're being sincere, they care. But he also talks in the video about people who give lip service, people who just say, yeah, we'll do that thing, but then they have no intention doing anything like that. And I'm just wondering, how does sociocracy kind of deal with that? Because one of the things that could catch consent is if you had enough no-nos in the house, maybe nothing will happen. So what have you seen, Ted, in the wild, and how have you kind of dealt with that?
Yeah, I love the question. And there's so many things here, but the two things I want to go to look at is lip service, because somebody is just simply not willing to use their brain, you know, like people are just like, yeah, whatever. So it's basically a lack of willingness to be responsible. Those are the people who are like, yeah, whatever you say. That's a dangerous one. Well, both of them are dangerous, but that's dangerous because ideally consent leads to shared responsibility. That's also why, for example, in consent, we don't let people stand aside or abstain. there's no, oh yeah, whatever, just do that without me kind of a thing. Like, just like, no, if you are part of the decision makers, which we haven't talked about of who's a decision maker and who isn't, but if you're among the decision makers, I need you to say consent or objection, and there's nothing in between, which means if you consent, you're co-responsible. So it has to do with, first of all, a culture of responsibility, but also about who is even in the room to say those things. What I want to say about that is it's hard to pin it down in the decision-making moment, that lip service aspect, at least the first kind, because it depends on why that person checked out. Why are they even a decision maker? Do they have to live with the consequences? And we tend to build decision-making groups around who has to live with the consequences. And then typically people don't defer as much if they have to deal with the consequences. So that's one kind. The other kind that I tend to be even more worried about is when people give lip service because they're afraid, when it's a power dynamic, because that takes even a little longer to address, because all the old behaviors that we've both internalized or that are part of the culture of an organization, they don't just go away because you use a different process. So that requires some deeper work. And that's also where we say that sociocracy is just a tool for governance. It's not meant as a personal development tool. So if people have that tendency to just defer to whoever is the most powerful, it's only going to snap them out of it over a longer period of time.
Thank you, Ted. In chapter 2, you talk about the organizational structure and straight away kind of gets down to the idea of a circle. What is a circle, Ted, and what's so important about it?
Yeah, circle is kind of the basic building block of an organization, basically like a team. So what we need to know about a team so that it makes a circle is several things. One is who's in it. And decision, I mean, circle membership is typically by consent of the other members. So if we already have 5 people and the 6th person is asking to join the circle, then the 5 people need to consent to that. Because there might be, just like in the previous example about consent and objection, there might be some real reason that they say, no, if you're on the team, I'm really worried we won't be able to work because we're stretched too thin, because our group will be too big or whatever. The next thing that we need is the aim, so that shared purpose of that team, it needs to be completely clear. And then we typically also need to know how we're connected to the organization. So where do we link into the organization? What's our place in it? And that's important so that we know what our aim is. I mean, what our domain is, what can we make decisions about? Because different from your regular team that might be able to self-organize around the work that they do, a sociocratic circle is allowed to make decisions about anything that's within their decision-making domain, and nobody can overrule that. So there's no higher up that can undo what a circle decided. So that's a big difference that goes towards that decentralized decision-making.
Yeah. You got sub-circles as well, I noticed, Ted. So that's kind of like a little bit of a hierarchy. Well, it's not so much hierarchy, but if there's something that is a particular concern, I don't know, like the brand style guide in a marketing department or something, maybe there's a brand style guide circle or something within the marketing circle. Would that be kind of a typical example of a sub-circle?
Yeah, and I'm not afraid of using the word hierarchy. Like, we typically, you know, make the distinction between a top-down hierarchy where whoever is at the top can decide what, you know, change whatever decision at the bottom. Instead, I think of it as what we call a natural hierarchy that comes kind of from natural systems. You know, it's completely clear to us that a leaf on a tree is part of a bigger something, right? It's part of a branch. A branch is part of a tree. A tree is part of a forest. It's part of an ecosystem. The fact that things nest and in a way have a hierarchical relationship to each other is just how things come. That's a matter of how systems work, that they're nested. So if that's what you call hierarchy, fine, it's a hierarchy. In that sense, sociocracy is hierarchical because we want things to nest so that we have clarity on who decides what. So, and then, as you say, we have circles, and circles have domains and aims, so we know what they're doing and what they make decisions about. And then they can, if they choose to, take a part of their domain and their aim from a sub-circle and give that to them. And now that sub-circle is the final decision maker on that thing that we've given them. So in that way, we tend to only keep manageable chunks of power in a circle, and the rest gets passed on so that there's always somebody who's on it.
And I noticed as well that you can have a single link to another circle, but you can also have a double link. And you seem to be encouraging the idea of a double link so that you get, I guess, more fluidity of the information at one person, because we all have limited views. We have our own mental models, haven't we? And two people kind of seeing what's going gives a greater chance that we're getting the right information in between the circles. I think that was the basic idea.
Yeah, the basic idea of linking, then even kind of more foundational just for listeners, is that the idea of a link is that if you have a circle and a subcircle, then at least one person, ideally two, are part of both of those circles so that they can bring information back and forth, so that we have kind of a solid, robust, yet flexible connection between the two. Because, of course, if somebody is taking care of the subset of your domain, you would want to know what's happening there, right? So, and then some people call that circular hierarchy, because in a way, with this information flow in both directions that you've been describing, kind of one person bringing information from the subcircle to the circle and one person bringing information from the circle to the subcircle, it kind of, the pattern that exists with that is, in a way, everybody's reporting to somebody. So that's why some people call it a circular hierarchy.
And you've got very, very useful checklists as well for how to define domains. There's a checklist for that. You've got some examples as well for each of those. So it's really easy to read. But then you talk about a membership circle. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? It says here, for example, a membership circle might have authority over a policy that defines a membership status for the entire organization.
So, let's see, what is a good example? I mean, that is a good example. Maybe I'll just stick with that. I just want to contrast it with the leaf at the branch at a tree, on a tree. So ideally, all of these levels make their own decisions, right? And that might mean that, like, different from a tree, where it's kind of clear that a leaf sort of, in quotes, makes decisions about only itself. It can't make decisions about the leaf next to it. And I don't know enough about trees to know whether leaves influence the branch that they're on. I do not know. But in many systems, that is the case, right? In interdependent systems, that is the case. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if we look at the interdependent systems within a human body, right? If your muscles move more, then you need, like, then your heart will beat faster and so on. So there's interdependence between systems. In the same way as the human organism and the organs in it are the different systems, it also works with the different systems within the organization, like membership. So let's say we have HR or membership. They make decisions, they make policies that not only apply to their circle, but apply to everybody or that particular HR or membership aspect on everybody in the organization. So again, we want a place for everything where it can be decided. Sometimes people translate or they kind of sloganize sociocracy to a level that simplifies it and takes away that part of the wisdom when they say things like, oh, those who are affected can decide. But that's not true. It is that we place authority intentionally, and that might mean that one circle might have power to make decisions about some aspect of the whole organization. It's a little abstract to grasp, but I think the HR example is a good example, that they can make HR policies, and that's what it is for the whole organization. If you don't like it, you have to go to them and convince them.
Deeper into the book then, in chapter 2, you talk about roles within the circles. So a circle leader, for example, also a facilitator, a secretary, and a delegate. And I think you said, well, basically the leader could be the facilitator, but it's kind of like a separation of concerns, because you might be a good leader, but maybe not a very good facilitator, things like that. So also allows for everything to be kind of looked after, because a facilitator could also be looking out for, or do we have equivalents within the circle, whereas the leader is kind of thinking more about maybe direction setting, things like that. But can you explain more about the secretary and the delegate, Ted, what they do in a circle?
Sure. The secretary is simply in charge of making sure notes are taken. And circle minutes, so meeting minutes, are pretty important in a system like sociocracy. Because if you imagine, like, my organization, the nonprofit that I co-founded, we have 200 people, 50 circles. Each of them making decisions on their own, right? With fairly minimal oversight, I want to say, if any at all. Now, that means that if a circle, let's say IT circle, decides something that will likely affect me, I want to be able to go into the meeting minutes and understand where the decision came from. So transparency and being able to read each other's documents is super key, because it's one of the things that information flow and shared access to information holds everything together. It's kind of one of the sources of alignment in all the decentralization. So that's important. So the secretary is, you know, not just typing what people said, they also help make sense and help things in order. So that's a pretty key role. And then what was the other one? Oh, the delegate. So we talked in linking about the two people that bring information back and forth between a circle and its subcircle. And the leader is one of them. The idea is that the leader reports top down. They hear in the wider organization what needs to happen and then go to their circle and say, so here's what's happening and here's what needs to happen in our circle because this and this and that. While the delegate is the voice that is bringing information from the subcircle to the circle and might say things like, you know, here's what we're struggling with. Here's how we're doing with this. Here's what's important to us. So that is how that directionality is being kept up. And that is really the only thing that delegate does, is being that second voice to even out the leader voice.
And I also saw as well, deeper in the book, you talk about the different types of circles. So you have, for example, a mission circle, a general circle, a department circle, and then you have sub-circles kind of hanging off those as well. The mission circle seems to be key for the organization. Can you tell us a little bit more about that one, Ted, please?
Yeah, and I want to tie this real quick, just in case somebody does know it, to a viable systems model, which is a body of work to understand how systems can be viable. It's that simple, to at least the highest level to explain it. And so sometimes people think in self-organization that all you need is a bunch of work circles that self-organize and do work. And of course, we do need those, and there's a lot you can do with that, but you also need other systems or functions in an organization to kind of hold it together so that the organization as a whole is more than just a set of work circles or of teams, but it can really act as a whole, as an organization. And one of those functions that we need is a circle that has in its domain the overall purpose or aim of the organization and tracks how well we are accountability to our mission, to our aim, to our purpose, to our values. And that circle at the same time also looks at longer term things like where are we headed overall? Are we sustainable? Should we change or question our business model and so on? So that's the mission circle, kind of that outlook and accountability partner to the operations part of the organization. It's very similar to an advisory board, at least depending on how you do an advisory board, but that's the very basic idea.
You also talk as well about how experts and communities can kind of interact with the circles as well and how that might look, and that all looks very interesting. You even have how organizations can work together with two sociocratic organizations working together, the mission circles kind of connecting, if you like, and everything rooting from there. There's a lot of thought went into this. What I'm curious about is, how popular is sociocracy, Ted, in terms of, since you've been involved with it, is there momentum behind sociocracy? What way are things going at the moment, and where is it most popular in the world, I guess, as well? What industries as well, maybe?
So this is a good moment to give credit because, you know, I've been kind of associated with sociocracy so much and so publicly that sometimes people seem to miss the fact that it's been around for a long time. What we did in Many Voices, One Song was kind of write the manual to a body of knowledge and practice that has been around for longer. So it's been developed in the late 1970s, early 1980s. I was just born then in the Netherlands. Gerard Entenberg was one of the, was the key person. And then it's kind of, you know, been around and used here and there and so on. But really, I think it was kind of ahead of its time back then. At least that's how I explain it. And then I guess around 2008, 2007, there was more in the US also, in English-speaking world. That's also, for example, when Holacracy was like kind of branched off, that is very heavily based on sociocracy. That's not a coincidence. And now I would say over the last 5 years, a lot has changed. And what has changed is that just it seems to right now be on its way, kind of in different industries at a different pace, but it is on its way to just, yeah, that's just what you do. You know, at least some of the parts, like for example, meetings, how meetings are held, consent decision-making, those are the ones that are catching on the fastest because it's the easiest to implement on team level, right? And who has the power? That's always a little bit of a sticky question, especially in kind of established organizations. So the industries, you asked about that, and geography, Well, it's, I think, Central Europe and the UK have, I think, the highest density of sociocratic organizations. And in the US, it's, you know, it exists, but compared to Central Europe, it's a little slow here. Latin America has sociocracy, you know, it's really all over the world. I mean, I know sociocratic organizations on all continents. Industries, you know, it's funny because we in our work get to work with all sectors. All sectors, you know, I've worked with activists, I've worked with software businesses, I've worked with schools, I've worked with co-ops, I've worked with every sector there possibly could be, I think, like, you know, the highest, like the big categories, governmental things. It is oddly strong in software businesses, among consulting businesses, intentional communities, nonprofits are catching on, co-ops have been catching on for a while. So those are the biggest ones. And I think it depends on whether there's a bridge, right? For example, agile. I mean, many people could describe sociocracy as basically scaled agile from the operational level to the governance level. So that makes sense. So it's kind of thought patterns or mindset patterns that people, principles that people recognize. So that's a way in, agile is. Non-violent communication is a way in. It's basically the same thing on an interpersonal level, but we do an organizational level. So it really, everybody kind of has their way in. That makes the whole thing interesting.
Deeper into the book, you explain the difference between handoff and handover. I'd never seen that before. I did notice someone making a distinction before, and I didn't understand it, but it was explained in the book here. And so a handoff is seen as a transfer of information or goods, whereas a handover is a transfer of authority. That could be a temporary transfer of authority, or could be maybe something more permanent. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and why that's so significant, and why you took time out to kind of call that out, actually, why that was something you need to draw attention to?
Yeah, because people get so confused about those things. So a handoff is just something that happens all the time. And I notice that with clients, they want to draw a circle structure and like what the organizational structure would look like. And then they get very caught up on, wait, but we can't make this and that decision. That also needs to be told to so-and-so, and so-and-so also uses that data. They should all be on the same circle. We're going like, wait. You know, like, who actually makes a decision together? And who just takes the data and does something else with it? Or who, you know, does the next step? Like, let's say a simple example would be between, let's say, a membership. Let's say we have a membership organization, a membership circle, and a finance circle. Right, and maybe that's even the example in the book because it's such a good one. I don't remember. But so if somebody changes their membership status, let's say we have two membership categories from, let's say, supporting member and working member, and somebody changes their status, then the finances, like, it needs to be billed differently, right, if there's a different fee associated to it, membership dues. Now, if it's a handoff, that means membership circle can just decide on their own and they just let finance know. So-and-so just changed status. Okay. That doesn't mean that that everybody on finance who deals with those numbers also needs to make decisions about membership. And that's where people get caught up. They see all the connections that are operational connections and they bunch that together into decision-making domains, but they have nothing to do with each other. Operations and handoffs are cross-connecting throughout the whole organization as they should be. That is separate from decision-making domains. And that's why the second one, the handover, is a transfer of that authority where I'm saying, okay, from now on, instead of me deciding who is a supporting member and who's a working member, you decide who's a supporting member and who's a working member. So now I've transferred not just information, but now I've transferred a whole piece of who decides what. And since an organization is basically a big game of who decides what, it's a whole different nature of a thing to do. But people aren't clear, you know, they kind of throw out information and they throw out, please do this for me, and they throw out a task, but they're not really clear. And that goes back to that intentional placing of authority, of areas of authority that we do, you know, that we pay so much attention to. If people blur those lines, they're typically in trouble because then they step on each other's toes and then somebody gets upset. That's just a matter of time.
Another thing that sociocracy would be kind of fairly well known for would be how well meetings are run and stuff like that. And I wonder if you could maybe give an example of maybe a recent meeting that you witnessed that isn't kind of giving any confidentiality away, but the kind of the style, you know, what could a listener expect sociocracy is in the building, you've got circles set up, they're all connecting, you got double links, all that kind of stuff, and it's moving fairly well. But someone just kind of drops into the organization and they witness a meeting happening within a sociocratic organization. What would they notice?
So yeah, when I observe client meetings quite a bit, and often before they're sociocratic, so I see the difference. You're like, oh, gee. Yes, they are very enjoyable in sociocracy. Actually, that's the one thing that drew me in the first. I was part of meetings here in the community. I was like, wow, this is fun. Like, how is this so much more engaging? And I remember that I just found that meetings, instead of draining me, kind of pulled me in. So how that happens is that, you know, I talked earlier about how in your typical organization, there's kind of a strong individual view, but sociocracy really tries to bring more towards that shared purpose and towards that shared alignment. And one way of doing that in a meeting, how that manifests, is that we often do rounds, which is the practice of just asking people one by one. Like, for example, let's say I have an idea. Let's say, hey, we could also do this and that. A typical thing a facilitator would do and said, okay, Ted just had an idea. And, you know, if we have the time, unless there's something else going on, they would now call around, and now each and every person in the circle would speak to my idea. And then after that, we would have some information about whether this idea holds water or what's happening with that. And if it seems worth pursuing, then maybe now the facilitator would ask me or themselves restate the proposal, like make an actual proposal out of the idea, and then ask for consent, which then again would ask every person, either with thumbs up or verbally, to see if they consent to moving forward on the idea. So we're basically constantly aligning with each other, like around our ideas, around our questions, around, like, so we're really trying to, you know, people like this image of a flock of birds, how they fly together. Rounds are basically that a manifestation of flying together. You're constantly together by doing these rounds. And to me, although I know for people on the outside that sounds tedious, it actually saves so much time, because we don't do the back and forth. Nobody gets upset. We're just always moving together. And it's that unity that really makes it very strong, while allowing for the individual voices that might be different, you know, allowing for objections. So somebody walking into meeting rounds are the first thing they notice. They notice that the role of the facilitator is a little different, I would say. It's kind of more hands-on for sure. And a little bit more technical, I want to say, just to really make sure that the group is moving forward. I also would say that people's talking turns are shorter than what people are used to. You know, in your typical meeting, and you like just a run-of-the-mill company, there are at least two people that talk a lot. And that really decreases in rounds, because kind of that, yeah, competition for airtime just fades away as a behavior. That's what I see again and again. So it seems to just have more togetherness and more flow to it, those meetings. And that's what I love so much about them. I really don't enjoy kind of run-of-the-mill meetings anymore at all. Like, I despise them, honestly. I've really been spoiled by how good our meetings are.
It reminds me of liberating structures. Everybody gets a voice.
Yeah, and it's one of those beautiful examples of how effectiveness and equivalence are not at odds with each other, right? Because sometimes people think that, and I just think that's such a fallacy. It's not a zero-sum game. You can actually be effective, maybe even more effective, at least equally effective, by moving together, and instead of giving one person so much weight, to kind of level it a little bit and do that flock of bird kind of movement where we're all together and everybody is one equal, but we still have structure and we know how to move forward.
In the book as well, you talk about hubs. I think you're kind of hinting at something like United Nations or some kind of international organization where actually you don't really have any control over what the individual countries do. They'll all yap and talk and blah, blah, blah. You have those mission circles that be kind of a hub in between them. The key difference is, I think, that there's no real shared decision making. It's just a central place for sharing information. Is that pattern becoming more popular, the hub pattern, or is that something that you just see every now and again?
I don't have the information but it gets more popular. I mean, there sure is more efforts to build coalitions, kind of, because the issues that we face we as humanity are just so systemic that one organization can't really do much. So that's why we need to build these collective impact situations, right? But the interesting thing about any coalition or collective impact situation is that, as you say, organizations are sovereign, like you can't rule into an organization. So let's say I'm executive director or CEO of a self-organized organization, and I meet at the table with six others. I can't promise that my IT team is going to do this or that. I simply can't promise that because that's their decision. So it changes the nature of how these things go. So it's all about more kind of alignment and that shared information. And by the way, it's not an unheard pattern. Like, for example, like how standards are written often is like in working groups that find consensus and where it's then a voluntary self-commitment to stick to those standards, for example. So many of those things that in which consensus or unanimous decision making and equal voice together with being sovereign, so that autonomy alignment game is actually not as uncommon as people think. So I think one can build that out a little more.
Thank you, Ted. And in chapter 3, then you talk about making policy decisions. So I'm guessing these are kind of the rules of the game. I'm not sure if I understand this correctly. And I think you talk as well about, well, how those policies get changed and so on. Are there particular circles that would be involved in actually making these policy changes, or is that something that can happen in any circle?
I appreciate the question because that's a big difference to what people think. Every circle, any circle can make policy decisions because any circle has a domain in which they make decisions, and they have two ways of making decisions. Either they just make a one-off decision or they turn it into a rule. And the difference, the way I describe it is, okay, let's say my daughter calls me and asks me, can I stay out till midnight? If I say yes, our assumption would be that I said yes about today. I could also sit down with my daughter and say, hey, how about we do, 11 on school nights and 2 a.m. on weekends? I don't know. She's almost 18, so that seems appropriate. So that can happen on any level, right? It can happen on how does membership work. There might be like a one-off for one member, like we're making an exception, or there could be a rule. It happens on HR for sure. Like it happens just on any level. So it's not that policies are made on top and then people carry things out at the bottom. That's a hierarchical thinking that doesn't apply here. So policies are made by any circle in their domain.
Thank you, Ted. One final question. So you mentioned earlier that sociocracy has kind of branched a bit, and there's probably bossa nova, there's something going on bossa nova, there's holacracy, there's sociocracy. How would you say that the work that you did and the work that this book is about is, what would be the main differences, I guess? I know it's out of the scope of the book, but is there a kind of a dummy's guide to what's maybe different about what you're doing versus maybe what other communities might be doing?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of two directions. One is to combine sociocracy with other things, like in Bossa Nova, and that's fantastic. The one of the authors, like both of them were close with, one of the authors was on our mission circle for quite a while because that alignment and information was really, really interesting and kind of fruitful. That said, that's a combination of pieces. And then the other one is iterations of flavors of kind of the core of sociocracy, like Holacracy and Sociocracy 3.0. The difference here is, well, let me take them separately. Holacracy is basically a way to standardize more. Sociocracy has a lot of choice. That is great because it's a lot of choice. It's also a little harder because that means one has to choose. And it's a little bit like, like an open source system and then like Linux and then a particular distribution. It's exactly like that. Sociocracy is kind of a free fall in all kinds of different ways, and you can combine it, you can whatever, you can do anything you want. It's a free and open system. While Holacracy is kind of one particular rule set in it that made a few changes that put it slightly outside of what kind of is normal in sociocracy, but some of the things are also just codified sociocracy. So that's Holacracy. Sociocracy 3.0 is more of an approach, and that's very close to us. We have members in our organization that teach Sociocracy 3.0. I personally don't, but there's a lot of kind of back and forth between that. Sociocracy 3.0 kind of has a different way of basically packaging it, in that they try to give people all these different things that I've talked about kind of into a package, you know, each of them, and then you adopt package by package and mix and match them as you want. And I think that's great because it gives people a lot of choice. And I also am a little critical of it because I think that the value of sociocracy is that it's a system where all the pieces fit together. So as soon as you patchwork too much, you also make it slightly inconsistent. And then I don't have full confidence that people would use the patterns that I think they should use. You know, it's a little bit like if, you know, my kid built their own bicycle, would it be safe? I'm not sure. So how much can people choose and pick and choose? That's kind of an open discussion that is a hot, always a hot issue.
Ed, thank you so much for coming on the XJD podcast. Really enjoying your book. I'm sure the listeners should check it out as well. It's very well written and very easy to read. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.